Hello, this is Sarah Jackman, and today I'm joined by Nikki Richmond, lawyer, managing partner, and head of training at Breacher, the West End law firm known for its work in the property sector. Nikki is active for both developers and lenders, including Amazon Properties, British Land, and mid-market lenders like Maslow Capital and United Trust Bank. And she's amassed in that time over 30 years' experience in the field. Good morning, Nikki.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us today. Your career spanned over three decades, and in that time you've built up an appreciation of just how important it is to develop skills beyond drafting, negotiating and reading black letter law, all hugely important skills as a lawyer. But there's a lot beyond that. Tell me a little bit about your role mentoring young lawyers.
I am head of training at Breacher, and that's a sort of global mentoring. We have a mentoring system in place where partners generally mentor junior lawyers. Mm-hmm. But my role is to have a global overview of training, to set a training programme for all the assistants, but also to teach them the skills that aren't black letter law, the soft skills. So I run training sessions on those types of skills, like how to deal with difficult clients, how to manage your email. It's much more soft skills and individual development focus rather than legal training. We do that, and a lot of people do that within the firm, and mm-hmm. we have the usual programme of lectures and out of house speakers. But I think that it's really important to actually train people on those things that we, having done it for many years, think are obvious, but mm-hmm. are not obvious to juniors.
Of course. And just in terms of having a rounded skill set, just how important is that?
Well, I think it's absolutely essential, because I think clients want a rounded person as a lawyer. And I think that to be a good lawyer, you have to have both the academic ability and the intellectual skills, and also emotional intelligence. There are very few areas of law where emotional intelligence isn't important, because mm. you're in a sales business at the end of the day. You're selling professional services. So you have to be able to work out what the buyer of those services needs. And it isn't always just, here is the law. It's the way you deliver that law and how the client needs to hear it.
Okay. Just in terms then of the actual sessions that you run, you mentioned a couple just now. Let's have a little think about difficult conversations and dealing with potentially difficult clients. How does someone who isn't terribly experienced in the field, who's just gaining their confidence and really getting into the role, how do they approach those situations? What sort of tips can you offer them?
Well, they're very hard, and they don't necessarily get easier. So understand that those conversations are difficult for everyone. So one has to work out one's own way of coping, and that will be different for everyone. But for me, the things that I do are things like I stand up, because standing up makes you feel more in control. I also breathe. And we sometimes forget to breathe when we're having a difficult conversation, because when somebody is shouting at us, we go to our sort of monkey brain and we have the fight and flight response, and our heart starts pounding and we don't really even hear what that person is saying to us anymore. So the most important thing to do is to try and remain calm and try and listen to what's being said without reacting emotionally. And often what I will do if somebody's shouting, and shouter clients are really difficult, don't get me wrong, I find them very difficult. No one likes to be shouted at. Mm. Shouter clients often just need to be let shout, and they'll sort of wear themselves out. Silence is a very good tool. Mm. And I always just hold the phone away from my ear while I'm standing up and let it finish. And inevitably they go, are you still there? And you go, yeah, I'm just listening. And often they hear themselves after that, and it will calm the thing down.
Yes, it's quite disarming, isn't it? And sort of diffuses something.
Yeah.
Okay, so that would be one way of dealing with
yeah.
it.
And another way is sometimes when you feel the words coming at you, if you're having a face-to-face meeting, it sometimes feels like you're being battered with those words. So if you visualise those words going over your shoulder, not into you, that's useful sometimes as well. So just let them sort of wash over you, and the most important thing is to breathe and to not take it personally.
I suppose that's one of the things, isn't it, when you're involved in one of those sort of scenarios, it's very easy to think that, you know, it's something personal and something that you've done to trigger that. How easy do you think younger people find it to actually recognise that it's not their fault and to come and seek help? Because I suppose that's one of the things, just recognising that you can get help and you can sort of tap into somebody like you and your experience.
Absolutely. I mean, it's why I run the training sessions, because I want, if I can give a sort of work hack to somebody, I will, because there are certain tricks that you learn over doing this for a long time. But I think it's absolutely essential to understand that you are not alone. I certainly know that when I was a junior, I used to think it was only me that struggled, mm-hmm. because everybody else acted all the time as if they never made a mistake and they didn't find anything difficult. And I think 30 years ago, that was more of the culture. I think it's less problematic now to show yourself as a vulnerable leader and as somebody who does struggle with those issues. And I think that's quite powerful. So people don't feel, oh God, I'm not coping, or I'm the only one who can't do this. Understand that everybody finds those conversations difficult, and do go and ask for help and say, I've had a difficult conversation. Could I have done that differently? Mm. Could I have done it better? Even with the person with whom you've had a difficult conversation, when it's diffused, you might be in a position to actually have a sort of helpful conversation after and say, look, I know that didn't go as well as planned. I found that quite difficult. Is there anything that I could have done differently?
I mean, that's a very interesting tool, actually, and I guess sort of really helps bring together, you know, the client and the lawyer in I guess what will be a sort of ongoing relationship.
Yeah, you have to put yourself on their side and work out what they're trying to achieve. I mean, there are some clients who are just really difficult to deal with, and I think there does come a time when it can verge on the bullying. It doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. And you have to have the confidence to go and speak to your line manager or your superior and say, I'm not sure whether this is appropriate or whether I should be accepting this behaviour, whether that person is always like this, whether they're just under particular pressure. I think it's useful to understand the drivers. It's useful to get feedback from other people who've dealt with that person.
Yes.
It may have just been they've had a bad day.
Of course.
They're under particular pressure and you're the punch bag, which I'm afraid in a service industry is sometimes the case. And I think you can learn tricks from those incredibly irritating people who are on phone calls for services where you're ringing up to complain and they've got tricks to diffuse you, you know, saying, I'm sorry that you feel like that, but rather than I'm sorry I've made a mistake, there are deflection tools that you can pick up and use.
Yes, no, that's interesting. One of the other areas that I know you're very interested in mentoring people is the networking and marketing side of the role, which I think has grown enormously in the last sort of decade or perhaps last 20 years. I mean, is that something that chimes with your own experience? I mean, do you feel there's more pressure now to really focus in on the marketing side?
I think marketing is a very broad term. What I always experience with the new set of trainees or assistants that come into training is the, oh my God, I can't go into a room. They assume that marketing means going into a room of crowded people and coming out with 5 business cards and new leads and turning it into a new client the next day. That is part of marketing, but I would say that's 10% of one. It's one of the possible options. And I think you also need to look at internal marketing and external marketing. And I think the more junior you are, the more important the internal marketing is. And as you become more experienced, external marketing becomes important as well.
Okay.
I do think that you have to understand your own personality before you work out which sort of marketing is going to be best for you. And I always suggest that people take the Myers-Briggs test, which you can find online, It's quite revealing and quite accurate. Then set out a marketing plan for yourself.
Okay. Are you able to explain a little bit about how the Myers-Briggs test works, what sort of questions that involves?
What the Myers-Briggs test does is help you work out your strengths and weaknesses, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, and the things that you're very good at. It also helps you look at how you interact with other people, and also talks about what sort of jobs you might be suited for. And I think it's very accurate. And okay. The people that have done it within my practice have found it to be very revealing and helpful. Because I think it's important for people to create their own marketing plan, both internal and external, and actually work out, firstly, what they're trying to achieve. For me, the very worst type of marketing is scattergun. It's a waste of time and it's unfocused. So just going to an event because you might meet somebody there, I'm not really prepared to do that. I want to see more bang for my buck, frankly. So I want to target more specifically the people or the things that I'm trying to achieve. So I work out what my goal is before I do any marketing event. So it's not just randomly hoping to bump into somebody. That will happen. That will be part of your marketing strategy. But some of it will be raising your own profile. Some of it will be raising the firm's profile. And it might sound strange, but what you're doing is you're creating your own marketing brand, your own personal brand, your own personality, because you are doing both. And I always say to people, when you're marketing the firm, you're also marketing yourself.
Yeah.
So you need to understand who you are and what you're selling.
Yeah, it's a really interesting approach. That 10% of the time then that someone would be expected to go out and do the networking and to work a room, what practical advice do you have for someone who perhaps is an introvert who does find that scenario quite difficult?
Try and find out as much as you can about who else is going to be there. And with data protection, it's not so easy these days. And if you can, go with a colleague or try and find somebody that you already know, so you're not walking in to a room on your own. There are always people straggling on the outside. You can start talking to one of those. What I do find interesting is how many people don't really know a lot about their own firm or business, certainly as a junior. And I think it's quite useful to have a little crib card for yourself of how many partners are there in the firm? What does the firm specialise in? You need to actually understand the firm before you can talk about it. But actually, what you actually are trying to do is find out about the other person. The very worst thing you can do is talk at somebody with a prepared script. You actually need to listen. And we've all been to events where people are talking to us, but they're looking over their shoulder to see whether anyone more interesting is in the room. That's a really bad thing to do. And one of the hardest things I find to do is getting yourself away from a limpet, like clinging to each other in drowning in a storm. You actually really need to try and say to yourself, actually, I've spent half an hour with this person. It's either, I like them, but I'm not here just to have a one-on-one conversation for an hour. I need to circulate. You just use an excuse. I usually say, I've got to go to the loo. Mm-hmm. And then you come back into the room. But understand that it's hard. It's hard for everyone. And everybody is there to network. And at least half the people in the room will be thinking, oh God, what if those people don't speak to me? And I'm very conscious when I'm in that sort of group of people hovering on the outside of a group. And I always try and bring them in and say, you know, with my body language, have open body language and bring them into the group. I think there are groups that you can't join, and it's recognising when that's happening and not being rebuffed. But again, it's not taking things personally.
Yes, of course. And that's interesting, actually. So not just a tip there for people going into the room, but also for the hosts, really, to sort of think about inclusivity and just to be aware of that when running an event.
That's a very, very important thing. When we run events, what we do is we look at who's there on the guest list and we work out who needs to be introduced to who. We also ask people when they come in, is there anyone that you'd like to be introduced to? Because they can usually see the guest tags or the list once they're there. And we're very conscious of having people, you know, on their own, standing in corners. And I have been to very badly run events that have wasted the opportunities in the room, where I've turned up and nobody has said, who do you know in the room already? So I always say to people that when we're doing our events, go and ask that person who they need to see, who they're with. It's just being, again, emotionally intelligent. And it's really interesting that the events that aren't run by people who know how to run events are usually a waste of time. They might cost a fortune, they might have fantastic food, but you can really feel the difference.
Just thinking then back in the office and the sort of practicalities day to day, working through your caseload and so on, a lot of juniors will be sort of just assimilating to the role, just getting to know everyone in the office. And there may be some reticence just in terms of delegation and being able to speak about how they can offset some of their workload if they're going through particular pressure points and so on. What tips do you have and advice for people who are just learning those skills and really looking and learning how to delegate and manage workload effectively?
That's a very interesting question. I think that delegation is an art. I think it's something that you have to practice. I think it depends on the culture in your organisation. There are ways to delegate well, and that's about communicating, about speaking with the person to whom you would like to delegate, and that can be delegating downwards and upwards, and not just assuming that that person can help you. I've had situations where people have sent an email to people and said, I need your help with such and such, and assume they would do it, not checking whether that person has capacity or could do it. So the most important thing is to have a conversation, first of all, and to say, are you able to help? Can you take this on? And also to be really clear about the deadline and about what you're trying to achieve. And delegating is an art, and it's something that people don't do well generally. So I think that has to come from the top in an organisation, and it should be really clear in a well-run organisation that's had its delegation procedures properly sorted. It will be clear how you delegate, because there will be a protocol. It doesn't always work.
I'm sure a lot of the time it is about sort of building that confidence and just making sure that you are following protocol and having the right conversations at the outset. Just thinking then about how you manage other tools in the office. I mean, one of the other things in the modern office place is just the sheer volume of email that people are having to deal with day to day. How can people prioritise effectively?
Learning from my own mistakes, I've honed my email behaviour over many years, and I think I have finally worked out how to do it for me. It doesn't mean it's going to work for you. I think you need to be able to switch it off at times, and out of office is a brilliant tool. The problem these days is that everybody expects an instant response, but that instant response doesn't always have to be a substantive answer to the thing. The instant response can be, I'm in a meeting for an hour and I'll come back to you after that hour. Or I'm in meetings all morning, please send me an email or leave me a message. As long as the client knows why you haven't come back, that's fine. Better than an email going into the ether, you not answering for 5 hours because you're thinking, oh God, I know what they're emailing me about, and I haven't done that thing, because we've all done that, where we get an email and we think, oh, I'd forgotten to do that thing, or I know I haven't done X and I need to do it before I go back to the client. There are ways of managing that, but I think the constant availability is not necessary. And I think one has to have the confidence to block out certain times, because we all do it and it's incredibly disruptive. And I've been working out how not to be scattered and how to be able to focus. And the way that I have done it is that I block out between 10 and 12 every morning for thinking work and chargeable work. The rest of the time, my door is fairly open for the can I run this thing by you, can I check this clause, whatever it is. But between 10 and 12, I have no meetings, so I know that every day I have at least 2 hours in which I can firefight anything that needs firefighting and I can get myself sorted. I also do a plan each morning of what I have to do that day. Half the time it doesn't get done, of course, but at least I have a plan. So again, it's not having the scattergun, oh my God, let's just react to the latest thing. Yeah. And one of the very important things is, just because somebody's screaming at you in an email doesn't mean you have to prioritise it. I think you can go back straight away and just say, thanks for the email, I will come back to you by X. Manage the time. And if that's not fine, the coming back to you by X, they will let you know. But mostly it is. Mostly clients just want you to communicate. Putting your head in the sand, avoiding the phone call, all those things will not help.
I suppose one of the other ways in which people are constantly sort of engaged in electronic communication nowadays is social media. Obviously a very important tool just in terms of marketing and so on. But how do people really get the most out of it and manage that effectively?
Well, I think you have to, again, work out what you're trying to get from it. And I think you also have to accept that you have to keep it in check. I'm personally on a social media holiday at the moment because I found that actually it was taking up too much of my time and making me unfocused. So it's very easy because it gives you that amygdala hit and you keep looking at it and it ramps up and you get very involved with it. And it's another way of actually avoidance. So I think there's a clever way to use social media, and that's to actually be focused and to give it certain amounts of time, not to have all the notifications on your phone, so not to be interrupted. So it's focusing 100% on that thing when you're on it. So if you say to yourself, right, I'm going to give myself half an hour a day on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever it is, stick to that half an hour. Don't let it bleed into your day, which is what I did. And then because I'm an instant responder, so if I got a notification, I'd have to email back or respond or whatever, or message. And I found I was communicating with people on 5 different platforms, which is fun, but when you're busy at work, it's not practical and it's not helpful and it's another cause of stress. So I think you have to focus on what you're trying to achieve out of it and understand that you can't do everything. So it's really important to be able to be present in your job, to actually focus on your job, and to actually put your phone away for bits of the day. And that's a really hard lesson to learn, especially for somebody like me whose phone is glued to my hand.
You manage, I think, to blend the work and the personal very well. You're well known for writing a food blog. How have you found sort of blending the work and the personal, or indeed making that distinction and making sure that you do manage your life and your work-life balance properly?
Well, the food thing was interesting because I actually wanted to do some legal writing, and I'd done nothing other than being a lawyer for many, many years. And I started just doing some practice writing restaurant reviews because I've always loved food and I've always liked going out to eat. And I thought I wanted to write in a way that wasn't like a lawyer. And then the lawyer tweeted that they were looking for restaurant reviewers. And then I thought, well, I could do that. And I ended up doing, for 4 years, a weekly review for the Lawyer magazine. And when I first started to do it, my husband, who is an ex-lawyer, said, oh, you can't possibly do that because people won't take you seriously as a lawyer. And I thought, well, actually, what I'm trying to do is have some work-life balance. I'm trying to do something I enjoy. And it was a really good thing to do for marketing because all my clients like going out to eat. All of them like going to new restaurants, and many of them would ring me up and say, where are we going next? And because I have to do quite a lot of lunching and entertaining out, it was a way that I could combine the thing that I love to do, which was eating out, and marketing. So it sort of blended the two. And if you can find something that you really love and you're passionate about, you can connect with clients over that. Sometimes it can be a sport-related thing, or it can be something like the food blog. But I think you have to work out what your passion is and be authentic. And if you're authentic with clients, they can see that. I think clients, not all of them, but a lot of them like to have a lawyer with a hinterland and with a life outside of the office, because you're not just selling your legal skills, you're selling you as a person. And I found that it's been a brilliant thing for me to do. I'm actually, again, taking a break from that at the moment, and I'm writing about other things. But I've missed it, and I'm going to go back to it, but do it slightly less. Because, again, balance, for me, it got slightly out of balance, and it became like a second job. Mm. So, again, it's always doing that, looking at, am I doing this right? Do I need to make some tweaks? Could I do this in any better way? Is it still doing what I need it to do? For me, it stopped doing what I needed it to do, so I came away from it so I could actually look at how I could do it in a different way.
Mm. That's good advice. And as a mentor, you obviously derive a huge amount of enjoyment from it, and you're able to share tips and expertise and a wealth really of experience to younger professionals. What advice do you have for other people who might be thinking of dipping their toe into the mentoring field? I mean, what would you say are the highlights of being able to sort of nurture those younger talents?
The advice that I would give for somebody who wanted to go into mentoring is, it is one of the very most rewarding things that you can do in the office. It isn't a role that suits everybody, and you have to put in quite a lot of time and effort to do it well. We're not trained on how to mentor as lawyers, so you have to get some training. Whether your organisation gives it to you or not, you have to work out how to mentor effectively. And that means spending real time with people, being authentic, and letting them know that they can trust you, because mentoring is about the personal and the professional. It always comes up down to some personal issue as well as work problems. And I actually think that is the role of a mentor in the workplace. It's to deal with the whole person. It's a holistic approach. And I think you really need to care about the person you're mentoring. So for me, in terms of looking at how mentoring relationships work, I want to make sure that the right assistant is with the right mentor, because the personalities have to mesh. But the most important thing is, as I said earlier, you actually really have to care about the person you're mentoring. One thing you can't fake is sincerity.
Nikki, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you this morning. Really, really interesting, and some really good insights into the modern working practice and how people can best manage it. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you, Sarah.